Sean, I don't see Jim Waddell. Yes.
He has a tile here, just no video, it looks like. Can you hear us, Jim?
Yeah, I just forgot to turn on my video.
Okay,
let's come to order. This is the Pelham PUD Commission meeting for November the 22nd, 2021, virtual, of course. And welcome. So let's start out with our first item here, which is approval of the consent agenda.
I move we accept the consent agenda.
I'll second the motion.
Moved and seconded to accept the consent agenda for November the 22nd, 2021. All those in favor? Aye.
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 Okay, agenda revisions, do we have any?
Will, the only thing I've got is on business item number D. Tom Martin is going to give an update on the storm and related issues. And I've also asked Larry Morris to give an update on, he interfaced with EOC quite a bit during the last week. And so I asked Larry to give a little update on that too.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right. Then moving on to comments from the public. Sean, do we have any?
If anybody has a comment that they'd like to make, please go ahead and give me your first name now, and we'll call you in the name or in the order received.
Do you want it by chat or by verbal?
Verbal would be great.
Donald Baker from Clown Bay would like to ask a question.
Okay, go ahead.
You can hear me. I had a nice chat with Mr. Waddell on Friday, but the circumstances in Clown Bay need to be addressed, and CQ need to be addressed at another level. I have five issues that I need to bring to the board, and I just start labeling them off and then asking, you know, what you think, or I can just give them all to you to think about it. Okay, tell me what you want. I got five different issues about.
Go ahead. See if you can fit it in 3 minutes, if you would.
It might take more than 3 minutes. Number one, it's not the first time we've had a water issue at the well site on the Hoco River. It's been flooded in the past. I would have thought that you guys would have come up with a different plan to raise the pumps or put some kind of a barrier around the pumps so they don't get flooded, and we're down to one pump, one motor right now pumping for CQ that ran out of water. Number two, the Band-Aid that's been at Middle Point for over 30 years for a water line above ground to bring water to Clallam Bay was swept away by a landslide in a critical slide area that's been known to be critical slide forever, but the Band-Aid was on top of the ground and, of course, is gone. The response by PUD is a little bit late because of circumstances, but a permanent fix to that needs to be fixed. The temporary fix that's being done now, it will be adequate to get us by, but it's not the solution we're looking for in the end run. Number three, back when urban growth was being brought to Clallam Bay and CQ and proposed to the Clallam County Commissioners, the comment was made that the PUD was the franchise provider for water and power to the unincorporated areas of Clallam Bay and CQ. And another alternate water source was going to be established and another tank source. I'm not looking for an interruption there, I hope.
Yeah.
The water was going to come out of the Clallam River source and be pumped to another tank and to provide additional water to the prison and back to Clallam Bay and CQ if necessary. That's never been put in, although there was a promise that was going to be in the future and be done. The other thing is not all people in Clallam Bay were told that we had an issue with water and that we needed to conserve like crazy. Nobody conserved that I know of. I talked to 9 people that never got a notice that are paying citizens that have paid into the water system, PUD water. We're never notified of that. That's kind of a breakdown in the communication, I believe, and I think that needs to be addressed also. The response from the PUD is been a little bit late, but I appreciate all the water and stuff that's been provided to Clallam Bay at this time, and that work is being done, you know, basically 24 hours a day to get that new water line over the top is very appreciated. And if we get that in by Thanksgiving, I'd be amazed and very appreciative of that too for our citizens. But we don't have fire protection in Clallam Bay. I'm surprised you guys didn't bring a truck out here with water for the fire department, not just the fire department to use for water for the community. In case we have a fire that they need water today, they can't hook to a hydrant or anything. So our citizens do not have fire protection as such for the long term to put a fire out. And I think that something needs to be done for that immediately. You know, not just a tanker for the community for water. I'm talking about fire protection services to help the fire department in case they need a tanker of water. I don't think nobody's pushing the DOT to have the slide removed fast enough so you guys can come up with a permanent cure for the water line. I think that that's necessary and should be thought about and talked about. And a permanent water line past the critical slide area that emergency management people have been talking about for over 30 years, and there's been P&E people in the past involved in this process, and there's nothing been done about that. I don't think there's any excuses for that when you say you will, and nothing's been done. And I think that there's a real problem with that on the emergency management side, because we all talk about the tsunami, the earthquake, the critical slide issue, not having access to CQ and Nia Bay, and I think that our little tiny little road we have from the prison graciously opened up to let us through to get to CQ and Nia Bay is not the big fix. We don't have the water. We don't have the power. Your power line system out there is great at this area because of the critical slide. You put in huge towers to accommodate the critical slide. You did nothing with water. I think that needs to be addressed. And an alternate water system is probably required for this community to grow. I think it's necessary and should be thought about more than just in this meeting today. You should have other meetings and discuss it and try to get it done.
Okay, Chris. Thanks for your comments.
Okay.
What else we got, Sean?
I heard no others, but if anybody would like to make a comment, please let me know now.
Chris Hansen, Clallam Bay School Principal. Do we have an updated timeline of when the water is going to be restored? Because we are out of session until the water is restored to our school, and we will not have students on campus until the water is tested clean. So do you have any timeline?
There's an agenda item coming up where we're going to discuss that whole issue.
Okay.
I'm going to wait for that. Okay, but thanks for your comments.
Do you want to move that up, Will, so that that's the first agenda item?
Let's just leave it where it is. It's fine,
okay.
I think.
Okay, I heard others? No others, Will.
Okay, we'll move on to business items. First item is the 2020 Census and Redistricting Commissioner Boundaries. Sean, I think you've got that one.
I do. Hold on just a second. I'm going to share my screen. Okay, can you see it, Will?
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay. Okay, so I'm just going to go through a few slides here today to talk about the PUD's redistricting progress that we've made so far and give you our recommendation for moving forward. So the first slide here, just a little background on redistricting. So governments have to redistrict every 10 years immediately following the decennial census. And normally we would do this a little bit earlier, but because of COVID, there were some delays from the federal government in getting the census data. Nonetheless, we are at this point here. And at a high level, redistricting is the process of changing voting districts so that all districts have as close to equal number of people as possible. And as communities grow and change, the individual precincts grow and they tend to get out of balance. And so the process of redistricting brings the voting districts back into balance from a population perspective. And so for our PUD specifically, this means that the 2020 census prompted internal review and we determined that a rebalancing of the three commissioner districts is necessary at this time. So to meet the state statute, we have to adhere to five criteria when drawing our boundaries for the three commissioner districts. And I've listed them here in these five bullets, but the districts basically need to be nearly equal in population as possible. You have to include entire voting precincts, and so since you can't split them up, there's never going to be an exact number of people in each district. The districts also need to be as compact as possible. They don't advise that you have winding geographic districts that cover odd shapes and territories. They want it to be as compact as possible. The districts also need to be geographically contiguous. So in other words, you can't put a West End precinct with a precinct on the east side. All the precincts have to actually physically be touching each other. You cannot favor or disfavor any racial or political group in your districts. And finally, to the extent possible, you have to use natural boundaries and preserve existing communities of related and mutual interests. So those are the five areas that we have to meet per statute when drawing our district boundaries. So this map here, I know it's kind of hard to see, but this is our existing map. And this was based on the 2010 census. And most of the population growth, as you can see on my mouse here, has, you know, been in this area over here. So the population and the precincts need to be shifted from west to east a little bit in each district to accommodate more equal boundaries. So this is the current districts right here. So if we were to leave them the exact same as what we are today, you can see from the numbers down here at the bottom, we would have a 31.8% to a 35.03% spread between the populations. And so District 1 would be heavily overpopulated compared to District 3. So we need to rebalance these and bring all three districts as close as possible to population. And so to accomplish that equal distribution of population, these are the proposed changes that we're recommending. So precinct number 251, which is Mount Pleasant, we would move that from District 2 over to District 3. Precinct number 259, which is Prairie North, that would go from District 2 to District 1. And then precinct numbers 222, Dungeness East, and 240, Jamestown, would go from District 1 over to District 2. So by making those changes, you can see that we would have a less than 1% deviation from each of the three districts. So the biggest spread is between District 3 at 33.6 to 32.88%. So under about 0.75% difference between all of the all three districts if we make those changes. And so this is what that map would look like. So this blue district right here, you can see with my mouse, this would go from District 2 to District 3. This one right here that's green, this would go from District 2 to District 1, and then these two down here, again, I know this is hard to see, but these two right here would go from District 1 over to District 2. So this map right here is the one that we're going to propose on December 13th and ask for your adoption. So these are the proposed districts based on the previous map. Again, you can see the population spread down here. So these would be the changes if approved. And then one final thing that I wanted to note, during the redistricting process, staff became aware that in doing our research, the district originally did include the city of Port Angeles upon the district's formation in 1940. It was a countywide vote to establish our public utility district, but the vote for district commissioners was countywide up until 1981, when the district began excluding the city of Port Angeles voting precincts. And based on our research, there is definitely good justification for excluding the city of Port Angeles. First, we've been using the current redistricting method for the last 40 years, which does exclude the city of Port Angeles precincts. And during our research, we were unable to ascertain why the change was made in 1981, but we believe that there were public policy concerns with a large unserved population base voting in PUD elections. And also, We believe that the city has a preference that the PUD not provide redundant and competing services within the city. There definitely are arguments that can be made for inclusion and exclusion of the city. However, there are reasons that the commissioners may want to consider, such as county residents not served by the PUD voting, again, in PUD elections. Non-served customers voting in our PUD elections doesn't make sense practically, so staff is recommending that you adopt the previously proposed map from slide 8, which follows the same redistricting procedure that we've used since 1981. And that map, again, will be presented in its final form along with the resolution for your adoption at the December 13th meeting. So with that, that's just kind of a high-level overview of the districting process that we're at right now. The map was in your board packet. Again, I know it's small and difficult to see, but I can send out a larger map and put it on our website, too, for anybody to view. So any questions, commissioners, on that?
Yeah, Sean, you said that we haven't been able to determine why they made that change some years ago. Have we checked with the Clown County Auditor's Office or the clerk of the board of the county commissioners? Because I'm sure they must have, but obviously they dealt with this.
We have, Jen, that's a good question. So we've scoured through the previous minutes for our board meetings, too, to find out why that change was made. And there's nothing in the minutes that definitively says why the change was being made. We've also checked in with the county, as you suggested, and really all they do is receive our resolution and our districting maps, and they have no records as to why a decision was made. They just actually receive the map from us and process it based on the voting precincts.
Okay, thanks. Do we the process for redistricting, do we have to have a public input process to this, or we just make the recommendation? We take the recommendations and the three commissioners, approve it or whatever?
Yeah, so it sits on our website until the December 13th meeting, and the public can make comment on it at the December 13th meeting, and up until that meeting, they can send in email comments as well, and we can present any comments that we receive at that December 13th meeting.
Okay, thanks. That's all I have.
Sean, this is Rick. I support the staff's recommendation, because I don't believe it makes sense for folks that aren't served by the PUD to be able to have a voice when we have elections. So I think that's a good idea. I'm wondering if we should try to fix this problem before the next census happens. So I guess that would give us 10 years to change the charter. Do you know what steps would be needed to make that happen?
Yeah, I believe the most practical method to do that would be to seek a legislative fix through the Washington State Legislature. And that would require us to work with our attorneys to move something like that forward.
Okay, I'm hoping that wouldn't be, or maybe the better way to say that is, maybe we can get an estimate from the lawyers on what they think the cost would be, but leave this issue now that we're aware of it, I don't think makes sense, and we should try to fix it so that folks going forward won't have to deal with it.
Yeah, I can absolutely reach out to our attorneys, Rick, and ask them to provide us with their best estimate as to what it would take to seek a remedy like that.
Thank you, Sean.
Yeah.
Well, I think I'll just state the obvious that Port Angeles has its own utilities, electric, water, and wastewater. And in the past, there's been no interest in the PUD serving within the boundaries of the city. So anyway, we'll see how this goes. All
okay,
right.
Good.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, commissioners.
All right, our next item is recommendation memo. I can't even read this. Oh, it's for a 100-foot aerial highline bucket truck. And that's Jason. I think you have that one.
Yes, thank you, Commissioners. So good afternoon. I'm Jason Seibel, Operations Superintendent in the Carlsbad Service Area. I'm here today to ask the board to approve staff's recommendation to purchase an Altec AH-100 100-foot aerial highline man lift, hydraulic operated, with an aluminum flatbed mounted on a new Freightliner Model 114 SD diesel-powered chassis. After evaluation of bids received from Sourcewell Contract 012418, we recommend the district award the purchase of the previously referenced equipment in the amount of $496,649 to the lowest bidder, Altec Industries. As previously conveyed, we are asking for the purchase to be approved by the board earlier than we have in the past years. The purchase for this is to secure our equipment in a spot on the manufacturing line ahead of our other buyers that will approve as we have in the past in March. There will be no monetary obligation until the build is completed. We just want to reduce our build time by getting our request in early. This item was part of the budget the board recently approved. So thank you. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Jason, is this replacing existing equipment?
Yes, it is. It's replacing our 100-foot bucket truck that we have right now.
And it's going to be used district-wide, I assume, not just
correct.
All. Yeah. Okay.
Yep, yep. All the way across the PUD, yes.
Any other questions, discussion?
Does this particular truck improve our capacity in terms of height or anything like that?
It's additional. I mean, it's not additional. It's pretty much replacing a 100-foot bucket truck that we have right now that has issues. And
okay.
It'll be the same reach.
Okay, do I have a motion on this one?
I move that we accept the recommendation to purchase a 100-foot aerial highline bucket truck.
I'll second the motion.
Been moved and seconded to authorize the purchase of a 100-foot aerial highline bucket truck with a flatbed on a new Freightliner 114 SD diesel-powered chassis per the Stonewell contract, and not to exceed purchase amount is $496,649, not including Washington State sales tax, from the lowest bidder, Altec Industries. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, our next item is the proposed 2022 strategic plan. Sean, I think you have that.
Yeah, just a minute. I'm going to share my screen again here. Okay. So in your board packet is the complete strategic plan. However, I'm just going to go over the few slides here that have some changes. We did not do a deep dive this year. That's on the agenda for next year to update the 2023 strategic plan with a deep dive. So on this one here, I'm just going to go over the changes that we've marked in red. So on the first one is provide stable rates, the identify big gaps to the picture of excellence. Item B here, let me use my pointer. So item B here, this, for whatever reason, we had the Energy Information Administration, which is wrong. It should be Energy Independence Act. So we fixed that. And then over on the strategic initiatives, we had the create restricted capital account to proactively plan for CETA compliance. We did create the CETA account, and so now we want to review and maintain that in 2022 to make sure that the funds that we're putting into it are going to be enough to sustain compliance with CETA. So those are the changes on this particular strategic initiative here. The second one is on manage our resource portfolio. So again, some minor edits here. On the electric side, We crossed out integrated resource plan because we don't actually do an integrated resource plan. We're a load following customer and we just do the resource plan. And we also added in the CEIP, which is the Clean Energy Implementation Plan. As you remember, we adopted that for next year last month, and we need to do that on a biannually basis moving forward. And then lastly, number five here, John has been working on developing time of use rates for our utility. As we implement more and more AMI meters, I'm hopeful that we'll be able to get to a point where we can do a pilot time of use program here in the near future. So we added that into the strategic plan for next year. On managed risk, the changes are under the strategic initiatives. The first one here is number seven. We added and ensure adequately incorporated into district ERRP. So basically, we have a COVID safety plan that the district is operating under right now, and we want to make sure that for future pandemics, if one were to occur, that we have the information included in our emergency response and restoration plan for the future. And then number 10 is an addition. It's a big one for us this year. We want to implement a multi-factor authentication solution to meet the cybersecurity insurance mandate and to harden district user system sign-on requirements. As you've heard me say in the past, our insurance premium for cybersecurity or for cyber insurance is more than doubled with less coverage. So this is becoming a hot button item, and we need to make sure that the district is prepared for the future as these types of crimes increase. And then finally, on be financially responsible, the big gaps to the picture of excellence. We created a cash reserve policy this last year, so we struck through that one. And then under strategic initiatives, monitor and review cash reserves and debt service ratio policy. It used to be say established, and again, we did that this last summer. Manage low-income CETA program to mitigate rate impacts. We implemented our new CETA low-income program back in July of this year. It went into effect in August. And then finally, number eight there, scoping plans for utility-scale qualifying CETA projects and corresponding restricted cash accounts. So, again, it used to say maintain, but now we're going to move into the scoping phase of these projects here. So those are the main changes that we have for 2022. Again, we will. It was included in your board packet in its entirety. These are just the changes I wanted to go over with you guys. So, any questions on those changes or anything that you would like to see?
Hey, Sean, just that this will be on the website too for comments and commissioner comments too for the next meeting.
Yeah, Sean. One observation here is unless I just missed the fine print there, I don't think we have anything in here about the BPA's 2028 contract process and so forth. And you know, a year ago we were hardly engaged when we were putting together the plan, although we may have mentioned BPA and may have taken it out or something, but We're a year down the road now, and things are already, BPA is already shaping up things that I think provide substantial risk to this PUD, maybe more than the average PUD. But I think it's worth, you know, stating explicitly in our plan here that we, you know, something about that process and how to, what we can do to, not only, you know, kind of anticipate what might happen to us, but be an active player like we have been, I must note, in the various process meetings and so forth, whether it be BPA's meetings or the combined BPA-PPC meetings or other meetings like with WAPAG or stuff like that.
Yeah, that's a good recommendation, Jim. I just was thumbing through it here real quick. I thought there was something in there about the provider of choice, but I could be mistaken. But if there's not, I'll come up with some verbiage that I can propose for the next meeting.
Okay.
That would be good. Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions or comments?
I thought it looked good, Sean.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. What's the, Sean, what's the horizon for this strategic plan? I see Douglas is putting together a 100-year plan. I kind of wish him good luck with that, but.
That's incredible. We try to typically look out 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, that's what I thought too.
100 years doesn't seem very realistic.
No, you'd have to have a very high definition crystal ball to do that.
Well, they have a dam, so they better be looking out that far.
Well,
maybe they're putting in nuclear as well, so they have to think about the waste.
Well, good. We'll get Energy Northwest to talk to them. Okay, our next item is an update on storm and related issues, including crew addressing water shortages. That's Tom Martin and Larry Morris. Tom, you there?
Yes, I am.
All right, go ahead.
Good afternoon, commissioners. So the series of storms, as you well know, hit the area starting on Friday, November 12th, and reached an impressive intensity on Monday. Storm we haven't seen quite as intense in a really long time. Ever since I've been here, I've never seen a storm like this. And that's since 2006. So when it hit on Monday afternoon, we had some SCADA alarms that went off that indicated there were electrical problems on the Hoco pump station. And soon thereafter, we got a high water alarm. Also, we had a sensor in the bottom of the pump station. I really never heard that go off. And soon after we got that alarm, all data communications were lost from the HOCO and the CQ site. And state information was no longer available. So the HOCO River was flooded, and including the intersection at the HOCO was at Road and Highway 112. So Mark Hess, our serviceman out there, was stranded. He could not get to the pump station. He could not even get to the office. He was able to drive out west and check on the status of Island View, which was operating, was still in operations, although the creek was flooding the intake there. We heard about the landslide on Highway 112 around Middle Point, and our pipeline that runs from CQ to Clallam Bay runs right through that slide zone, and it was most likely the landslide caused the main break. But we couldn't tell because we couldn't get to the CQ reservoir to, find out whether it drained, because if that pipe broke, it would drain. But we assumed that it did. We just had to wait to see what CQ reservoir looked like. Clallam Bay, luckily, the reservoir there, we still had data communication. And there was water in that reservoir. The main break was on the CQ side of a check valve, which keeps water flowing in one direction towards Clallam Bay from CQ. So the main break didn't cause the Clallam Bay reservoir to drain, which was good, but we sent out robocalls immediately to customers in Clallam Bay to practice extreme conservation. And I believe we went through other routes, too. We tried to go through KLNT and radio as well.
I had a hard time hearing your last sentence there about
we sent out robocalls to all the customers in Clallam Bay, asking them to practice extreme conservation.
Yeah. And how did we do that?
Water demand so we can, so the water in the Clallam Bay Reservoir could last as long as possible.
And how was that notice given?
Through what we call robocalls.
Okay. That's the part I missed.
Okay.
So I'll just give a little color on that, Jim. So in our information system that we use for all of our customers, any phone number that we have in there, we have a software program that we use to send out automated messages to customers in emergencies like this. And so whatever phone numbers and email addresses that we have on file for customers, those are the numbers that those emergency notifications go out to. So if for whatever reason, if a customer doesn't have an accurate phone number for given to us, then unfortunately they would not receive those notifications.
Thanks for that addition, Sean.
Yeah, you know, just a comment. You know, a lot of people, and I know a few, they don't even answer their phones because they're all sales pitches or robocalls, as we use. Would it be a good idea to use multiple media to notify people?
Perhaps Tom said, Nicole also went out to social media and posted on multiple avenues there to we got the word out the best possible way that we know how. Utilize the radio, our robocalls, emails, social media. I mean, we tried to get the word out as quick as possible.
Okay, thank you.
John, would it be possible to, in maybe the next bill that we send out, that for each customer we list the phone number or contact information they've given us and ask them to update it if they need to, or would that be too onerous?
We don't have the ability to do that on the actual bill, but we could send out letters to customers asking them to contact us to update their information.
Just given what Chris was saying, that he touched base with at least 9 folks up there that didn't get the information, that might be something that would be worth doing.
Yeah, I know that our CSRs are trained to proactively, anytime that we talk to a customer and get them on the line, the first thing that we do is always update their information to make sure that it's accurate. But we can definitely look into something like that, Rick, if you'd like.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Getting the information out, while it's never good to have the power out, at least knowing why the power is out and getting some type of notice from the PUD, I think makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt there, Tom.
That's okay. Good question. So still on Monday, all routes to Colin A and CQ were shut off due to landslides and flooding. Lake Crescent, Highway 112 and 101, you know, south of Fort. So there was no way to get any help out there. So we're trying to plan.
Tom, can you move up a little bit closer so we can hear a little bit better?
Okay. There you go. So all the road access was out. We were trying to find other ways to get water to CQ. And so Larry Morris called to tell me that Costco had 3 pallets of bottled water. And, you know, I suggested that there's Thriftway, too, in Forks that would have bottled water as well. We just had to figure out a way to get it there. He asked, how much water should we ask for? And I calculated there was, about 1,000 people in CQ. And they need about 5 gallons of water per day. So we need 5,000 gallons a day. So I notified the State Department of Health. And this is a normal procedure when we have main breaks and emergencies like this. And I asked them for assistance in getting water transported out there. And so the regional engineer said that it is the agency in charge of emergency water supplies and is the state emergency management agency. In other words, the military, state military. And they coordinate emergency water supplies in these instances. So the Department of Health offered to contact this agency and try to get their help. So on Tuesday, access to the Hoco pump station was still cut off. The floodwaters hadn't receded enough. There were still landslides there, although Mark Cass was able to get there by foot. the day. And the electric crew helped Mark actually make it to the TQ office and the reservoir there, and he confirmed that the reservoir was empty. Sean Worthington helped with the policy on how to allocate a bottle of water once we get it, and basically on a first come, first serve basis. And it was really limited supply. It's just bottled water, and we couldn't get 5,000 gallons a day of bottled water. So we had to limit six per person, six bottles of water per person. That's the emergency response or operation center, whatever it was over there in the state or the county. You know, we have to work through the county to get to the state, but you know, we ended up having this, you know, DART emergency response group, you know, pilots who volunteered to fly bottled water several cases at a time out to the airport in CQ. And so the electric department and the fire district there in Toronto Bay CQ helped distribute the water at the community center in CQ.
What size bottles are we talking about?
Well, I was looking at the Costco website, and I saw cases of 16-ounce bottles. Well, it turned out what was delivered was 1 liter bottle.
One liter.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's 4 or 5 1-liter per customer. Is that right?
Yeah. So, okay. You know, Department of Health says in emergencies like this, you know, we should limit water used to 1 gallon per day per person. And, you know, I was saying, well, the Department of Health person told me that. And I said, well, you have to, that's for drinking water. That's for washing. That's for preparing food. That's for flushing toilets. 1 gallon is not going to cut it. So I said, how about 3 gallons per person? So we went through this whole debate there on how much. And, you know, we just tried to get as much water as possible out there. That's basically what it came down to. And later in the day, we found out that there was another slide on Highway 112 along Clallam Bay. It was a smaller slide, but it was about a half a mile east towards Clallam Bay from the big slide. And the road was being undermined and exposed our pipe and a couple of power lines, the communication lines. Our pipe was no longer had bedding. It was just kind of, there was nothing supporting it from underneath. So, and it's an AC pipe, which is fairly fragile. And for all intents and purposes, that pipe was unusable. So, at that point, I said, we're going to need water from somewhere else. The Island View water system, which was accessible, I thought that maybe we would have to be trucking water from Island View to CQ. So I asked for the water truck to be prepared and ready to go, and was at the PA warehouse. That's the same water truck that we used to truck water this summer during the drought from CQ to Island View. So I was hoping we could get it working up and running again. Mark did manage to get to the pump station by foot, and he said vehicle access would probably be ready by the next day, by Wednesday. So I called up Straits Electric. I knew we needed an electrician, and put them on notice, and they were ready to go. So on Wednesday, we were able to get Bowen Kendrick, Sean Delplane, and Straits Electric to drive out to CQ. They were escorted by the National Park Service Ranger along the Olympic Discovery Trail around Lake Crescent. And because, you know, 101 was just closed. And so we were lucky to get through. And the crew arrived, and with the help of the electric department, we restored operation of one pump in the HOCO pump station and restored the SCADA system. And we began filling CQ reservoir by the end of the day. And there was no evidence of any other main breaks in the distribution system. We were worried about that. if we just started pumping water up to the reservoir and leaking out of the pipe somewhere else, that wouldn't be as good. So it turned out that the reservoir was filling. We flushed the system. We took water quality samples and sent them to the county lab. We issued a boil water notice. So by the end of Wednesday, we were able to get CQ back in water. And Clallam Bay Reservoir still had some water. It was partially full. So at that brief moment, both water systems were providing full service. And but we knew that Clallam Bay would soon run out of water because the main break didn't allow it to convey water across, around the bay. And so we looked at, what's the next source of water to get. Larry Morris was looking into more bottled water. Our emergency management plan for the water department said, we should, look into Olympic Springs here in Carlsbad as emergency water supply. We call them up and they were glad to sell us a couple racks, 125-gallon jugs of fair water, and we got the materials department to go out there and load up with Olympic Springs water, and by the end of the day, we developed with the help of the crew developed a draft design for a new bypass pipeline. On Thursday, Lake Crescent opened up early enough. It was open until 9 o'clock and then shut down during the day and reopened at 3 p.m. So by Thursday morning, the Clallam Bay Reservoir was empty. And yet the materials crew was there delivering the Olympic Springs bottled water to Clallam Bay High School. So it got there around, 9. I got there about 10. We set up a water distribution center at the high school with the help of school and library personnel. And I was there helping out, handing out the 5 gallon jugs of water. David Rogers was with me, so we went out with Mark and confirmed in the field. We completed the design for the pipeline in the afternoon and walked the pipeline route. And we made plans for getting the crew and a contractor to start construction. So we selected Jacobs Excavating for doing the construction work. Last winter, they were the emergency response contractor on another break that we had on Highway 112 around Middle Point. So they were ready to go, and we ordered pipe and the other materials for putting together the bypass on Thursday. And so while we're doing that kind of work, the local helpers at this high school decided to move the distribution center for the water over to the library. And so that was kind of a surprise to me. So I went over to the library and got on a conference call with the school, with the library people, and with Travis. And, coordinated our operations for distributing water. And so we had bottled water left, and, we had the Olympic Cellars 5 gallon jugs. We knew that the folks were going to be running through that in about a day. So we were able to use the water truck to bring water from CQ to Clallam Bay so we could refill those 5 gallon jugs and any other containers that people may have. So we needed volunteers to help man that operation, and the local helpers told us that the county EOC would be coordinating any volunteers for that purpose. So that's when I left on Thursday. Might be a good time maybe to take a moment here to share a screen, Sean, to show some photos.
Yeah, go ahead, Tom.
You do that? Okay. Can you see that?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So here is the slide. So the whole mountainside came down above the highway. It wasn't just a little slide right next to the highway where a pipe was. That's about a 200 to 300 foot wide slide. And that's looking up from the highway there. Our pipe runs along just at the base of the, right on the edge of the highway at the base of the slide. Further east, this is where the smaller slide undermined the road and exposed our AC pipe here. See, there's nothing supporting it from underneath. That pipe is essentially broken. Here's the Hoco pump station. You can see all the sediment from the flood around it on the ground. There's a line kind of about halfway up close to where the wood siding starts. That's the high water mark from this flood. That's the most I've ever – it's never flooded since I've been here. I've heard stories about once before when this pump station flooded. So this is an extreme event. It doesn't happen very often. I hope it doesn't happen more frequently in the future. here's the filling station that was set up when I went out on Saturday morning. Here's our customer filling up the Olympic Sellers jug, and then we have all these Home Depot 5-gallon buckets that were, you could self-serve right there. And also later at the library, when the volunteers showed up, they were, bringing bottled water out to folks. So on Saturday, this is our crew working to put the inner tie on the east side, near Clown Bay Village, of the new bypass pipeline. And this is them working on the west side after they completed that. For the inner tie on the west side, they had to cut across the highway to install the crossing for the pipe to get it away from the major part of the slide. And you can see the thickness of that pavement on Highway 112. It's some of the thickest pavement we have in the water, in all of our water systems in Clown Bay. It's just layer upon layer of asphalt and concrete. there's our asphalt cutter that we had to go back and forth several times just to make it through. And actually, we destroyed the cutter this day because, so now we have to go out and get a new one. but they got it across today. And installed that actually on Sunday. So, back to my storyline. Well, I like to keep this picture up here of a happy customer. He's glad he gets water being supplied in this emergency. Saturday we completed, the west side excavation tie-ins. Sunday, they continued welding the pipe. The contractor was welding the pipe the whole time. The crew was working on the inner ties on both ends. And so the plan was to weld the pipe long enough so we could lay it over the slide zone and tie it in. One side and continue with the bypass all the way along Highway 112 to the village of Clown Bay. There was no way we could use our existing pipe. Who knows how many other slides there were or the compromised roadbed in the area. It was just too much of a risk to take to try to rely on our existing piping or even to run it through the damaged section in the second eastern slide zone. So I was at home, working my home office on Sunday, and I received a lot of comments coming in, Sean forwarded them to me and responded to them as fast as he could. And Commissioner Waddell gave me a call. He visited the site on Sunday. And he had some questions about the bypass design. I hope I answered them thoroughly for you and gave you a good justification for what we're doing. And then the crew decided that we would revise the pipeline route. We would just run the pipe all the way along the guardrail on Highway 112. We had planned on going down along the toe of the slope for a section just to get off the road, but it would save time. If we just left the pipeline on the road, it would be easier to install. So so I approved that. It was a great idea. The crew has been coming. They're the experts in this situation. I really rely on their expertise and their knowledge of the area. And so today they actually finished, with the help of the electric department, pulled the pipe across the slide zone, and they were bolting up the new pipe on the west intertie, and they expected to complete all the welding today and bolting it up together. The bypass was built in segments so that there was flanges on each end about 400 feet long each, so they don't have to go back and bolt all that up. So the plan for tomorrow is that we plan to complete bolting the pipe together, and then we're going to flush it, disinfect it, and sample it, and flush it again. And then the bypass will be connected to the east intertie and then put into service with a boil water notice tomorrow. That's the day ahead of what we had hoped to do. We're going to, one of the big time-saving measures is we're going to skip doing a hydrostatic pressure test, and we're hoping for the best in that. But, you know, we're in an emergency response situation. We have to take some risks. And we'll just have to keep an eye on it. And who knows if that slide is going to stay put. It could continue to slide, and we put some slack in the pipe so that if the ground did move from underneath it, it wouldn't just snap that pipe.
Tom, I might have missed this. You might have mentioned it. But the other I think another amazing part of this whole thing is that 6-inch HDPE pipe. Tell them how long it is that you guys welded together.
Yeah, we were able to put in a request for 4,000 feet of pipe on Thursday, and we got it delivered to the site on Friday. We started welding it, and it turned out the total length was 3,600 feet.
Yeah, that in itself is pretty amazing that that was all accomplished.
That is amazing.
So, Tom, let me see if I followed you correctly. You say at this point in time, it's Monday afternoon, that the 3,600 feet of pipe is completely welded now, or is drug into place. I mean, yesterday it was about, you know, it was three pieces laying there that went about maybe 800 feet. So are those three pieces all hooked back or drug down the road and across the slide area?
Well, they had maybe seven more sticks to weld together just before noon today. And so they can complete that welding. And they had started on bolting the pieces together, and they made it from the east tie-in all the way up to about the Spring Tavern. So, you know, as they continue to bolt and weld, they'll finish that tomorrow morning.
Okay, great.
So, Tom, so when will things be back to somewhat normal?
Well, somewhat normal, I would say tomorrow. There'll be a boil water notice on it. Not normal, but once we get the results back from the county, from the water quality sampling, We're hoping that maybe we'll get that on late Wednesday, maybe Thursday. And if it turns out that we pass the test, then we can lift the boil water notice.
Okay.
It's still abnormal that we have this bypass pipeline in place. That's going to take working with WashDOT.
Well, yeah, it appears that you've done a good job to get water back to the customers, but, you know, the most valuable thing about something like this is learnings. You know, so I would suggest you get your people around a table and see what went well, what didn't go so well, and come up with some contingency plans for future disasters. I'm sorry, Tom, but you have to deal with disasters.
Yeah, and there were really good comments by Mr. Baker earlier during the meeting. And, he brought up some really good points. We should have another source on the Tuolumne Bay side. And I believe we do have some old water rights over there, but I've never heard of any capital plan, facility plan to build out a new source and put in another tank. But I think that's a really good idea. You know, and we have been working on that problem area where the slide actually occurred. We did have, it's been a problem area. We actually had a pipe that came up and around the little creek there because it was an area that slid a lot, and that little bypass loop that we had in there was flexible so that it wouldn't break every time the earth moved. Well, it turns out, you know, I've been working on rebuilding the whole Tuolumne Bay distribution system for a couple of years now. And, you know, I've been going through I got two public works boards loans for this, you know, for the engineering phase and for the construction. We have $6.6 million awarded to us in low interest loans this summer. And so, you know, we have engineering designs now for that whole Highway 112, you know, for a fix for the, for that slide zone. Now, if we went ahead and fixed that pipe and just put a new one in, it would have been taken out by this pipe. It's enormous. It's 300 foot wide. And so I got a call from WashDOT saying, well, what's our plans to provide water? And they told me what their preliminary engineering, geotech engineering recommendations were, and that was to cut a bench higher up into the slope from the road and use that as a haul road to take out the debris material and build up a buttress on the water side. So the road would stay in place while we're doing this. And then eventually they'll probably replace the highway at that higher elevation where the bench is. So that's going to take a really long time. And plus, you know, the rest of the highway there all the way to Tuolumne Bay is in pretty bad shape. Our engineer consultant team that I had working on this last spring went through and looked and inspected all the culverts in that whole area, and none of them were in good shape. And that's where the second slide was a problem, because of the flooded up culvert. It's just a tough area. That whole road needs to be rebuilt. It's been neglected a long time. WashDOT required us to basically open cut the whole road and put all new pipe in casings. We need the price just tripled to replace the pipe along the bay there. And we just didn't have enough in our $6.6 million loan request to do that. So because of the WashDOT requirements, we backed off and said, hey, we're gonna defer this to later when we get more funds. So we really need to work with WashDOT on getting our bypass turned into a permanent solution.
Yeah, we have a question in chat that are the labs open on Thursday to test? You know,
well, we're going to get the samples to them hopefully by late Thursday late Tuesday or Wednesday. They stay open for us.
Okay.
For these emergency situations. So okay. they'll, They normally close Thursday at noon, and they have taken samples for us during weekends before. They're very good about that.
Okay, thank you.
Tom, this is Rick. I'd like to make sure that you pass on to the staff that we appreciate all the extra hours and long days that they've been putting in to get this problem under control. And back to Chris's input earlier, he characterized it as a Band-Aid fix. We really should put some thought into how we can better serve that area and go after the funding to make it happen.
Couldn't agree with them more. And I will definitely be pursuing that aggressively.
Thank you, Tom.
Hey, Tom. You know, it looks like we may be past, or we're coming to closure on the emergency part. Well, I would say phase two of the emergency, one being bottled water. Now we've got a temporary hookup. But it seems to me, well, it's obvious that the next phase is what goes on for the next couple of months with the road repairs, the slide removal. And while our pipe is laying there on the side of the road, which is not a great place, particularly once it opens up the traffic, but all that's going to take a lot of coordination and so forth, particularly where that culvert washed out below our pipe. And so I would appreciate, it's my request that, you know, we have a follow-up kind of a briefing in terms of how this coordination plan is going to look like over the next few months until we get to a more stable situation. And then I think we need to, listening to the comments that Don Baker had and so forth, wasn't five, it was like 8 points or whatever, is revisit the long-term solution for this, whether it is a pipe or is it another source in a reservoir or something like that. But anyway, I see this as a midterm and a long-term kind of analysis, and we don't necessarily have to, in the next month come up with a long-term solution, but I would, maybe that, after we get through this next couple months of this mess with the road and everything, and all that kind of stuff.
So Tom, do you have the Public Works, there should be funding for this type of situation, and do you have a line on that? That you say funding is a problem. Where can we turf up more funding?
Well, we already got a lot of funding.
Obviously not enough.
Yeah, I'm hoping that some of these federal infrastructure bills will be the money will start flowing from them soon, and. Just to let you know, when we applied for the Public Works Board loan for construction this summer, there were like 160 applicants. We ranked third in terms of need and readiness to proceed. So we rank up there pretty high in need, so I'm hoping that that will justify us getting more funding to do this restoration right along Highway 12 on the bay.
Hey, Tom, you mentioned the culverts there. Are these culverts that's going to be on WashDOT's list to replace, do you know?
No, they're not the Fish Passage project.
Okay.
They're too small and maybe steep for fish. But, one of the reasons why we didn't go forward with this Band-Aid fix in the slide zone because their culverts were deteriorated and non-functional. And if we were to even touch those culverts and try to move them around as part of our upgrade, then it would be our responsibility to fix their culvert. And, so that's the kind of coordination we need with WashDOT.
Right. Thank you.
These slides are pretty common out in that area. I know we've rerouted our power lines to make them less subject to that. I'm not sure you can do much with the water lines, but anyway, it's worth a look.
Do we have where the slide actually occurred? Was that potentially triggered by a culvert washout?
Possibly. The culvert, could have just backed up all the time and just kept it saturated. The storm was so intense that there may have been other factors going on in the watershed up of the hill slope that contributed to this. You look at an aerial photograph and some roads cut up above, stuff like that. I don't know.
Yeah, the culvert that you had in your photograph and that I saw, it was really a shoddy piece of work where they had a concrete culvert extending to the edge of the road, but the remaining, 4 or 5 feet was a corrugated culvert that was all rusted out and just basically blew right off the end of the concrete culvert and caused that erosion there. And I guess who knows how far it had gone if it had kept raining or if it rains again.
Yeah.
It will rain again, Jim.
But hopefully not that intense.
Yeah, well, let's hope not.
Yeah, it's been a neglected road by WSDOT, and major repairs are needed for that whole stretch.
Okay, other discussion, comments?
Keep up the good work, Tom.
Thank you. I appreciate your support.
We appreciate those weekend hours you put in and all your crews. So, anyways, thank you very much. Okay, moving on to the next,
I'd like to touch base because I was there involved with the EOC and their stuff.
Oh, I'm sorry, Larry. Go ahead.
Let's tie in with what Tom has said, but it's the other side that people don't see. And I first want to start with saying big thanks to Mark Heth living out there and trying to do as much as he could for not only his family but his neighbors. He was very good to work with. He put in over whatever he had to do. And the line crew guys that went out to help him dig out mud and muck and work with him, just fantastic. It really brought people together. The other thing is I'd like to thank the disaster airlift response team. When we first learned, I learned of it Monday afternoon. I'd been off with my wife. They called. I went to the EOC, and they said, we have an issue. And it's kind of a tightness in your stomach when they say they're running out of water and Clallam Bay is low. I mean, it's like, wow. Then you look up at the board, and every road that goes there has got line blockages, and how are you going to get there? We got water. We figured it out. EOC contacted the DART, the Disaster Airlift Response Team, Alan Barnard, and they said, if you get out here by 1 o'clock with the water, we'll fly it out there. And, man, it took us half an hour to get there, and I had two guys, and they loaded up those planes, and it was nice to see one plane after the other leaving and getting the water to CQ. When it got there, it had to be unloaded by some of our employees. They loaded it, they unloaded it, they put it on their trucks, and they took it to the CQ. I guess it's a conference room there. And those people just stepped up and said, David, here, we'll take care of the distribution. So then you could just see that the community was starting to jive together. So that's how it worked real well. Any of the bottles that we had left, we had to finish up the following day after three complete runs with five or six airplanes, and we had bottles left the next day, about 45 cases out of a normal 50. I'm trying to go a little fast, so I don't take up a lot of your time. So they took that bottle of water and sent it out there on Wednesday. They placed it in the CQ warehouse. The next step is, what are we going to do? And I'm glad they got 125 bottles of 5 gallon bottles of water out to us with Tom's help there, and that helped us go a little ways. We still had water coming in here left and right. There was times it was real are we going to get through this? But we got through it some way or another. The distribution of the water was set up through EOC with Noah at the library, Tori at the library, and Chris. He supported this at the schools. And also, that's when it kind of changed. We had an idea of where we were going to put it, but when it goes out into the field, they have a better idea, so let them arrange it where they want, and it worked out great. I just can't believe how well it came together with these people. We didn't have a way to get there. They found a way through the airplanes. They found a way, like Tom did, through the back rows there, which was great. I want to give a big thank you to not only the PG for supporting with the water, but Safeway donated plenty of water. And they're still, they brought some out as of Sunday night as well. Walmart, they called us on Wednesday. They pledged 28 cases of bottled water. Problem was they couldn't get there until today, but it's there. So there's a lot going on. A lot of people just came together. It's kind of nice that, and it's kind of sad, that in an emergency situation like this, people come together and they just make things work. And that was the community. That made me feel good. Big thank you to Mr. Peach, Commissioner Peach. He was on the Zoom meetings with us at 9 o'clock once in a while. This morning we saw Commissioner Bellion. I can't say his name. He's with the fire commissioner, Chief, fire number five, Bellingham. Anyway, Bill Benedict showed up as well. So that's just a few of them. And they had some good questions. Mr. Hansen had a couple of questions. I was there to be able to answer those questions. And those questions that I couldn't answer, I would go and get an answer for him and bring it back before we left our Zoom meetings. But I want to say thank you to everybody that participated, those workers out there, and the community. I don't want to say too much. I think Tom covered it real well with the process. But those guys deserve a big pat on the back. Thank you. That's all I have to say.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Larry. All right, let's move on to Resolution 222-21, declaring an emergency and authorizing emergency repair work in Clallam Bay CQ Emergency Water Repair. Tom, I think you have that one as well.
Yes. In these situations, we need to get a contractor going immediately, and also to get the materials they need for construction ordered and delivered. With this emergency declaration, we allow us to expedite the process and not have to go through a lengthy procurement that would just delay our response unacceptably. So the staff recommends or requests that the commissioners approve this resolution.
Okay, this is Resolution 222-21. Do I have a motion?
I move that we accept Resolution 2222-21, declaring an emergency and authorizing emergency repair work in Clallam Bay Siskiyou's emergency water repair.
Tom, I have a question. Is this for the work that's already occurred, or the rest of the work that needs to be done?
Well, this is for the work that's already occurred and is ongoing. So,
say that again.
Already occurred and is
okay.
Ongoing.
All right. All right. Thanks. I'll second the motion.
All right. It's been moved and seconded for approval of Resolution 2222-21, declaring an emergency and authorizing certain emergency work without formal bid for repair of the HOCO pump station and construction of a bypass pipeline on Highway 112 along Clallam Bay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you, Commissioners.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Good job. All right, our next item is the BPA post-2028 contract discussions.
If you don't mind, after the last meeting with the BPA and PPC on Thursday, Commissioner Pascal sent staff a couple of questions related to that conversation. And John has a short presentation to go over to hopefully answer some of those questions, if you guys don't mind.
Oh, absolutely. Go ahead, John.
Okay, I hope everyone can see the screen, 2028 BPA contract discussions.
Yes,
we see it.
Okay, yes. So Rick had several questions that touched upon a variety of the topics that we're hearing in PPC BPA discussions as well as WAPAG. And this might be good to basically kind of get alignment where possible on some of the issues, and I'm just going to run through. So basically, the first question had to do with should the RPUD support tiered BPA rates? Now, if we look back a while, as early as 2019, the initial BPA survey, we originally advocated for melded rates, using the argument that the tiered methodology was an overly complex and arbitrary accounting construct that should be simplified. And parallel to that, Ryan with WAPAG likewise queried WAPAG starting at the end of 2019 and on in future occasions. Unfortunately, it looks like there is a general preference of BPA customers to keep utilizing the tiered rate methodology.
Yeah.
And we believe that most customers are simply comfortable with what they know. Prior to tiered rate methodology, very few people are still around that, you know, knew what it was before, and it would be a sea change for most organizations. So at this time, staff believes that it is probably past the time to implement such a fundamental change. And we agree with Ryan that any effort to depart from tiered rates would undermine all other priorities that are under discussion. So basically, it would end up being a distraction, and it would be very, very hard to accomplish at this late date. Now, our initial concern was that BPA would differentiate carbon in Tier 1 and Tier 2 supply, which would be disadvantageous for RPUD if the 2008 contract high water marks were retained. And this is because we have a higher Tier 2 requirement than most BPA customers. Now, based on recent provider choice discussions, it now appears that BPA will have a difficult time differentiating carbon between Tier 1 and Tier 2 supply for practical reasons. And if so, we really don't have much of a reason to oppose tiered methodology. Also, recently, WAPAG and NRU has collaborated, which is giving members of those organizations greater weight in the contract negotiations. And tiered methodology is integral to NRU interest. So anything we did to undermine that would probably undermine the collaboration between WAPAG and NRU. So basically, our recommendation at this time is to support tiered BPA rates. Okay, a second question Rick presented is, how long should the new contract be? Now, it's our opinion that, by all appearances at least, BPA is very unlikely to seriously entertain something other than a 20-year contract, at least to do so at reasonably low rates. Any provisions for off-ramps or short contract terms are likely to be overly punitive with respect to rates, and it will be very difficult for us to dispute the BPA risk analysis as it applies to rates. So basically, if we go with shorter contracts, BPA is going to determine what the risk is and what the penalty is, and it'll be awful hard for customers to dispute that without a lot of effort. Now, on another hand, the contract, that if it ends in 2044, does align well with CETA. Now, we think the best in-between approach is to advocate for a running 10-year interval or look-ahead mechanism that would allow customers to bring on non-federal sources to supplant BPA with a 10-year look-ahead. There's a lot of arguments to do this based on the planning horizons of integrated resource plans and resource plans. And in all honesty, it should not be viewed as particularly high risk for BK rates, nor excessive negative rate impact. And as I understand it, there's another name for this in the contract discussions, but BPA is entertaining this, I believe, and we should make sure it happens. This would be a case that if we did want to bring in an alternative supply from BPA, once it goes into a 10-year planning for the utility, BPA would have to accept that as the planning BPA supply if we have to do it for either compliance reasons or for cost reasons. So that's kind of what the staff position and on the length of the contract.
Hey, John?
Yes, sir.
Another issue to be considered is CGS. Doesn't it, the contractor, it's licensed through about 2044 or right in that area?
You know, I don't know. What is the license period of Columbia Generation go through?
Well, yeah, Rick's right. But we're now working a couple of issues with Bonneville. One is to extend the license beyond that, another 20 years or so. And the other one is an uprate of the plant, which would have a pretty good price tag. And right now the BPA's position on that is that they're concerned because CGS is a single shaft resource. So they're actually looking at SMRs, and it's all, you know, it's an analysis. It's not a position, but that's what they're doing.
Well, it's a good point because over the term of the contract, Columbia is providing a substantial portion of the BPA supply, and it needs to be resolved definitely before we get into signing contracts. So hopefully BPA is aware of that relationship, Rick.
Oh, yeah, they are. In fact, we've got a meeting with BPA management early next month to talk about some of those issues.
Okay, the next inquiry that came from Rick was power supply products. Currently, BPA includes low following block and slice block product lines. And, you know, we really don't know a whole lot about the need or potential to migrate from that, but it appears to be universal agreement among BPA customers to continue the products, and we cannot identify any reason to depart from that if it's in the interest of BPA and most BPA customers to continue with those products.
So what are we hearing? I'm hearing that a lot of the large utilities, specifically Clark, is looking at becoming a load following customer, and their logic is that the BPA can provide a low carbon product that they can, and you know, address resource adequacy.
And that's a very good point. I think really early on, maybe even at the beginning of the process, we had a sense that with CETA, depending on what CETA ends up looking like, there may be an incentive for some customers who are now slice block or block may look at load following as the easy way out to meet a carbon mandates. But, you know, like I say, we'll have to see how that develops. Clark is the only one now making a lot of noise about that.
Yeah.
Okay, this is really the big issue. So contract high water marks. Okay, as you're aware, in July, WAPAG, Ryan originally presented five potential options for the determination of contract high water marks. Option one, basically retain the existing contract high water mark basis with no reset. Now, since Clallam has a disproportionately high Tier 2 requirement in the current contract compared to other customers, option one would allocate to RPUD a lower contract high watermark with respect to our requirements compared to most customers. Plowland would be, as most look at it, is one of the losers. And we also think that such a carryover from a previous contract, if disputed or not agreed to, would be difficult to legally defend. You don't normally take something agreed to in one contract and simply carry it over unless everybody's on board with doing that. Option two is reset based on an update of loads and resources. The opposite of option one, this would actually increase comparatively the contract high watermark for our utility because it's resetting it towards more current conditions. Now, I have a note on that, and this is an important note to remember. Note one at the bottom there, contract high watermark analysis should include multiple years as Clallam loads are very sensitive to minor changes in average annual temperature, simply because we do not have substantial gas heating or alternate heatings to electricity. And back in 2008 and 2011, we had some unusual weather that actually put us into Tier 2 requirements out of the gate, unlike almost any other utility. So you know, we need to be conscientious of that. If we get further into this, we would like the contract high watermarks to be based on an analysis that's more representative of an average year temperature-wise. Now, option three for Ryan was the average of options one and two, which would be a compromise to mitigate winners and losers to get a general agreement. But it does retain some of the negatives included in option one. Option four would be to provide each utility the higher of option one or two, would be a compromise to mitigate winners and losers to get a general agreement. Fewer negatives than option three, but it would amount to an increase in total contract high watermarks so that it's no longer represented by a critical water year. Option five, which I think everyone is getting away from, was to go back to melded rates, and we do not believe that's viable now, or at least at this late date. Any questions?
John, do you think it is feasible to change the high watermark at this point?
It's an arbitrary, and I'll get a little bit more into that. It is feasible. It'd be a change in thinking, though, how you view Tier 1 and Tier 2. And I'm going to go over another slide for that very reason, to make sure that everyone fully understands that the Federal Columbia River power system is currently equal to the available electric supply average expected over monthly intervals during a critical water condition, but not for all intervals within these months, meaning no matter, even at Tier 1, you have the need to go out for market purchases during high use periods in certain intervals of time. Contract high watermarks is a division of the Columbia River system to individual customers on a monthly basis. The federal system, and by extension, contract high watermarks, are not based on actual requirements over shorter intervals. It's a monthly interval, sometimes higher, sometimes lower. On average, that's your contract high watermarks. It is our current understanding that BPA cannot readily differentiate market purchases required for Tier 1 or Tier 2 supply. They look at the system in total. And to do otherwise would include some additional complexities that it appears they do not want to pursue. Now, basing contract high watermarks on critical water is somewhat arbitrary and does not equate to resource adequacy, which is an instantaneous requirement. So technically, to contract high watermarks based on something less than critical water would be required for true resource adequacy if you want to avoid market purchases entirely. Now, the question is, will carbon ultimately be separated are allocated to Tier 1 or Tier 2? If so, assigning higher contract high water marks would mean a higher Tier 1 carbon content, but it reduces the requirement for Tier 2, which is separately allocated would likely be 100% unspecified or entirely carbon. So it's a really complicated thing. So unless they do contract high water marks based on instantaneous requirements, I do not believe they can readily differentiate carbon between Tier 1 and Tier 2.
John, I've been trying to think about this problem, or I have been thinking about this problem quite a bit. And I, given what I've heard from Tim Johnson, which is their senior lawyer, Bonneville is not going to back off on the purchases that they need to make the system be able to meet load. But I do believe that one potential fix could be if the market itself were to produce a carbon-free product. And I don't think that that's too far-fetched given what's happened in the state of Oregon and Washington. And I don't think it would be that hard to make that happen. What might be more difficult would be to get Bonneville to agree that when they did make purchases from the marketplace, that they purchased the carbon-free product. And if we were able to make that happen, it would sure make CETA compliance a lot easier to deal with.
Rick, I think in the long term, that's almost required. So basically, keep in mind, BPA, at some point in the past with the tiered methodology, they kind of threw up their hands and said, okay, we have a limited supply, we cannot meet needs, and we need a mechanism to fulfill our full requirements customers. And they simply go to the market. It's an easy way out. And it's almost too easy. It allows them to set their generation, not look for new generation, not consider carbon. And when they need power, they just go out on the market. It's an easy way out. I think with Washington and Oregon and potentially federal legislation down the road, you're almost going to have two markets at some point. Unfortunately, for that CETA puts a fairly low bar for carbon and allowing carbon that could be mitigated by RECs at the 20% level, which means that it takes it most of the way through the midway through 2045, where people have an easy way to meet the CETA requirements, at least if you're a BPA customer and we don't have explosive growth. But I did hear on recent discussions during provider preference discussions that there's a lot of interest out there for some of the utilities to actually try to get to zero carbon before 2045. We'll just see how it develops. We probably should encourage BPA to do that, and they have to meet the requirements or full requirements customers anyway, and that may be the best mechanism of doing so.
Well, you know, Rick asked the question in this session of BPA, why can they not carve out carbon-free resources for public power here in this state, but they can carve it out for export to California? And that's, I heard the answer, but damned if I understood it.
Yeah, that's a question a lot of people are asking.
Okay.
It's a good question.
I didn't understand it either. But, Rick, another way to look at this is your question about, you know, those carbon-free assets. That's exactly what those thousands of megawatts of utilities or power generators that are trying to put power on the queue, on Bonneville's transmission system, they're lined up in a queue, 8, 9, 10,000 megawatts. They're banking on what you're asking is that, yes, Bonneville will have to go out, and they're going to be standing by with all this power. And that's also at a smaller level than the thousands already out on the queue that was modeled by the Power Council, and they came up with the same conclusion, is that there is going to be plenty of this stuff, and it's going to be cheap. The problem is BPA is not facilitating that. They're not – if you look – you should look at their QBR slides for how long it's taking them to process a request to do an interconnect. It's like 2 years for a small interconnect. It's crazy. So, you know, that's part of the bigger problem here. And the other thing, John, on one of your previous slides about off-ramps and long the duration of the contracts, I submitted questions to BPA after their one of their BPA, their provider choice meetings on November the 4th, I think it was, about the fact that they're not, you know, this uncontrollable cost issue is an excuse that we don't want to hear because it's a phony one for most of what, you know, they can address. They just don't want to address. They pretend like they can't address it when, in fact, they can. And a couple of commenters, even Will, asked it at one of the meetings recently, you know, well, what are those uncontrollable costs? And I asked explicitly for a detail of why they think they're – what they are and why they think they're uncontrollable, and I have not got an answer, nor have I seen that question posed. And the other question I said, well, you know, the problem with the – when people want an off-ramp, it's because they think – well, they don't think. BPA has raised their rates. And why is that? Because they can't control their costs. And the easy thing to do is, well, get at this. Get away from this idea that you've got to protect every one of your assets in the system as a complete system whole, and that you can't look independently at an asset and figure out its benefit-cost ratio and then make a decision about, before you get to the point of running off customers, should we retire an asset? They're ignoring that question, though, so far. Sean, I haven't seen it. Maybe you've seen it someplace. I wasn't at the meeting on Thursday. I had a conflict. But anyway, that's part of what fits into this discussion.
Yeah, Jim, that has been brought up on several occasions, and the BPA response does leave a lot to be desired. They aren't going to go into any minutiae, it appears, to demonstrate their position. Now the Power Council did consider the potential of extensive solar, you know, being developed. There are some transmission capacity constraints, but they're not anything that can't be overcome if properly planned for. And we think, staff believes that the BPA system is actually very well positioned to shape those loads. So, yeah, there should be, you know, there should be more consideration and discussion there. Now, there's one topic that this is my question. You know, the residential exchange. In a prior BPA PPC meeting, we found that under the current agreement, BPA is to allocate 14% of any Columbia River, Federal Columbia River Power System RECs created to IOUs. And I asked the question, but there wasn't a good answer. But keep in mind, you know, if BPA separates carbon attributes in the new contract, what is typically, let's say, a 94% clean power may all of a sudden become 81% clean, which is very close to the ceded limit of no more than 20% power from emitting sources. And I have a feeling that this is eventually going to be the biggest elephant in the room, of course, being related to carbon. Because if BPA has to provide IOUs 14% of the carbon, non-carbon aspects of their supply, where does that leave us? So we need to be careful, very careful about this in the next couple of years to protect us and ensure we have the opportunity to meet our state legislation with respect to carbon. So that's all I had. So I would, you know, this is mostly response to Rick's inquiries and stuff the staff has been looking at for a while as well. To keep in mind, if you'd like, I would forward this to you. If you feel like you want to take a specific district position on any of these items, you know, just let us know. It's up to you three commissioners to make those decisions.
Yeah, BPA did get back to me with some of their uncontrollable costs, and some of these sound legitimate. First was operational. Fish and wildlife, of course, we all know that. Litigation, snowpack, so on. So,
what about operations, Will? What do you mean operations?
You know, I'm a little confused by that one. They didn't explain that, but I think I don't know.
I think the water year is the biggest uncertainty with respect to operations. They don't know how much water they have or when it will come out. So operationally, they have to hedge themselves because of that. So that's how I interpreted that, Will.
Yeah, that sounds right. Okay, more discussion.
Well, this is good. This is one of the things that I find frustrating about WAPAG is that Ryan will come up and ask for a policy position from the PUDs, and yet, you know, unless we get together and have a meeting and talk about it and agree on something, all we can do is support individually. And, you know, there's a mismatch with respect to the timing. And I'm not sure how to fix that, but it's kind of frustrating when, you know, Ryan asks for a position and, you know, we haven't had a heads up to be able to discuss it among the commissioners to be able to give him that, what our position is. And like I said, I'm not sure exactly how to fix that.
Well, you know, we have to realize that we're a relatively small utility. And you just mentioned earlier about a position taken to complement NRU. And, you know, that's the way we'll have to influence this thing, through organizations, through coalitions with other utilities. So.
Well, a couple points I would like to make in this discussion, then, resulting from WAPAG meetings and also from the BPA's second financial plan workshop they held last week. I attended that. But back to the WAPAG meeting, one of the things that fits right into what you're saying, Rick, is there was a brief discussion about what WAPAG should say about direct subscriber service or contracts that, you know, the aluminum companies had historically, and there's not much of that left. It's been declining. And whether they should basically kind of hold the line with BPA and say that we don't really want to see those increase. And, you know, for the sake of public power, you know, for residential use. That struck me as tough on Clallam County because, you know, that's jobs to us. If we can't, you know, and I get complaints all the time from various folks in the county about, you know, how hard it is to somehow get, a new power agreement set up or something with BPA or a new load set up because of the constraints and so forth. So I don't know the right answer for that. I don't know even how to articulate. I did a poor job right now just articulating the problem, but it's something that John, you and John and so forth need to think about what our position is on this business. The other one is in BPA's financial planning workshop, they showed that chart we've seen a couple times about the forecast of remaining borrowing authority, where it showed it, you know, if we don't get the additional $10 billion that they did end up getting in this recent legislation, you know, what their outlook would have. You guys have seen this before, and you know, in there they've got a note about, well, you know, the borrowing authority is one problem or one thing that's been solved, but it does not address the larger debt management issues. And, you know, that's sort of some oblique language for the fact that this chart shows that BPA is borrowing roughly $300 million a year more than they're paying back. Now, I'm not an accountant, so I probably don't know exactly what that means, but it sounds like to me they're losing $300 million a year. And that, and the only thing that, you know, so it's either raise rate or keep borrowing money, but you're incurring more interest the more, and maybe that's the debt management angle as well, that's raising the interest payments. But the bottom line is that, we've got BPA is
is borrowing more money than they can pay back to the tune of $300 million a year. That's not trivial, and at least in my accounting, but I'd like some feed input from guys like Sean and John and so forth about, you know, is this a correct interpretation? Because this is what I'm seeing here is consistent with what BPA said in their 2018 financial plan when they showed the amount of debt and they showed the amount of borrowing and so forth and plenty of the other information that's buried in the weeds out there. But it's not what you hear talked about in these resource adequacy discussions and so forth. Or the post-2028 contracts, except to say, hey, our borrowing authority has been improved. So that's sort of my input on the 2028 process comments. And I appreciate if whoever's taking notes on this would kind of maybe summarize some of these points in the minutes of the meetings. We didn't do that much last time. And so, but this is important stuff, and I think we need to a simple summary just to for the public to note that we're really, Clown is really pushing hard on a lot of these issues. And I must say, a lot more than many of the other utilities, it kind of surprises me that they're not raising their voice about some of this stuff.
Okay, have we exhausted that one?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. Correspondence communications, I don't believe we have any. Is that right, Doug?
Yeah, nothing today, Will.
Okay, commissioner reports. I think we probably exhausted it all, but let's try it. Jim, you want to go first?
Let me double check my notes because I may have covered a lot of my, I did cover a lot of my stuff, but let me do somebody else and let me check, see if there's anything else. Oh, yeah, Waputa. But, let's see, where are my Waputa notes? Okay, that's financial plan. Okay. So I sat in not as a voting member. I'm not a voting member on much of the Waputa stuff, if any, but on the Energy Committee, Nicholas talked about the CETA rules need to accommodate BPA. Grid reliability was discussed at some length and meeting with legislatures. They claim the grid is tight, which I'm not sure what that meant. And they said they wanted to get the legislator to figure out, Washington legislature, how to figure out grid reliability. And I asked them, how the heck are you gonna, how are they going to do it? That's basically what Genesis does. Waputa was suggesting things that I think they submitted on Friday to the Power Council about things they wanted to, you know, their comments to the power plan. And one of them was they wanted, they were going to suggest that the council remove the resource adequacy analysis from the power planning process this time. And I commented that, well, that's step number one. That's fundamental. If you don't have a resource adequacy analysis, you can't develop a plan, and that's the whole point of the power plan. And so so I'm not sure what the, you know, I guess they just didn't like the council's resource adequacy assessment. And so the response was, we'll take it all out. Well, that's kind of pointless to do a plan that you don't have a resource adequacy plan for. So I brought that up as well. I listened in on the board meeting on Friday morning, but I was also on another call, so I didn't really capture any notes. But I wasn't a voting member anyway, so one of you guys can report out on that.
Okay, Rick, you want to carry on?
At the WAPAG meeting, it's been decided that Public Power will create a concept paper by March or April of next year that will talk about what the customers are looking for. Basically, we decided that it made sense for us to put our oar in the water first rather than let Bonneville do that. The paper will be dealing with system size and allocation, system capacity, contract flexibilities, carbon and cost control, and contract terms. The other thing I thought was noteworthy was WAPAG's proposed 2022 budget. Last year, their budget was $365,000. Next year, they're proposing $400,000, so that's an increase. But personally, I find that WAPAG has done a very good job, and that that's money well spent by the PUD, so I support that. That's all I've got, Will.
Yeah, I agreed with that too, Rick. Hey, one thing that was pointed out in the where I forget it was WAPAG WAPUTA. I'll bring it up later. Go ahead, Will. It's buried in my notes.
Okay, I sat through a number of the WAPUTA sessions, starting with the roundtable. It's always interesting to see what other utilities are doing. I think I've already mentioned that Douglas is working on a 100-year plan, so we need to consider that. They also talked about their hydrogen, their clean hydrogen plant that they're doing there. Grant, as a new commissioner, he's a college professor, so you're kind of raising the bar here. They're building additional substations to accommodate Microsoft server farms at Quincy. And I'll move on to Chelan. They've got a new general manager. There are a lot of new general managers popping up throughout public power. They mentioned that their capital budget is $300 million. And, of course, they've got Rocky Reach Dam, which probably explains a lot of that. Jefferson discussed that they had 10,000 customers lost power during the recent storm. Thanked everybody for mutual aid. They mentioned that we had our own problems. We did have some problems, but I'm not sure we raised to that level. Mason 3 is increasing rates by 3% and also increasing their service charge. And Skamania kind of stood out. They have a 7% increase. No discussion on what why that's the case. Also set in the telecom group committee. They talked about the 22 legislative session. There's a lot of energy around reopening the issue and doing a cleanup bill on broadband authority. And WAPUTA's concerned about retaining PUD's broadband authority because there is opposition from the telecoms. Kind of interesting that, there was a broadband office formed in the state government with Russ Elliott as its director. He's resigned and moved on to another job. They haven't replaced him. And so most of the broadband issues are going to the Department of Commerce and the UTC. They think that maybe the federal infrastructure bill could provide some funding, additional funding for broadband. And most of that's aimed at the middle mile grants, which is an equity grants. So that's where that's going. Kitsap gave an interesting report. They didn't go into specifics, but they're forming broadband LUDs in their service area. Of course, Kitsap is mainly broadband and water. They're really heavy into fiber. But there might be some learnings there for us. During the Energy Committee, talked about the CETA. CETA rules. The UTC is formulating some rules, and the Department of Commerce is waiting to comment and kind of use those rules as a go-by. Let's see what else we got here. A lot of talk about grid reliability. There's more interest in that. The statement was made that with electrification, that the average home will require twice as much energy as it does now, which means that that's additional rewiring, that's additional substation work, and, of course, additional resources. And there's a lot of concern about that. Well, I'm probably going on here too far. Talking about gubernatorial government affairs, the there's a bill that's being considered called the Customer Rights Bill, which would give you a sampling of what it's all about, that any disabled person would never be shut off. And they don't tie that to a needs. I mean, there's a lot of disabled people who are quite self-sufficient, so that's going to have to be worked out. There's four bills for electrification, building standards, and part of that would be that the utilities would finance fuel switching. And they felt that that probably is unconstitutional, as well as the fact that you can electrify everything, but you know, that puts the burden on utility customers. The other thing that was talked about was cities within PUD service areas that put on very stringent fuel switching, outlaw the use of natural gas, and require building standards to be increased. That you know, if utilities have to participate in that cost of those, should there be a surcharge for customers within those cities, just to protect the rural customers? CETA is talking about having declaratory, being able to issue declaratory orders, which would really come down to the Department of Commerce regulating PUDs. So they're trying to oppose that. And we've already talked about BPA issues. I think we're good there. And there's also Craig Blackwood came in to talk about COVID issues. I think all that's changed. Governor Inslee, he made that presentation on Thursday, and Governor Inslee came out and changed it all on Friday, so I won't even talk about that. But that's all I had.
Well, I found my other point. It came up at the
Okay, sure. Go ahead.
And Nicholas was talking about the BPA's RA program, and he noted that they're going to use historical data to establish a generation output for the hydro system to establish their RA requirements. So I think that's a good idea, because the generation data doesn't lie. And there's a lot of theoretical calculations about what the hydro system's producing, but the best thing by far is the actual generation data, and it's out there. And, it, you know, in five-minute increments for every turbine in the system, or almost, except for the little tiny ones. The other thing, that they had a briefing on the RA program presented by the Power Pool folks, and also somebody from the Northwest Power and Conservation Council, Ben Kahula. I came in late. I had the WAPAD call that was going on at the same time, so I only heard the last 30 minutes, but I looked at the slides, and one of them is this, and they didn't have many. The Power Pool only had like one or two slides, but one of them was this chart that they showed us 3 years ago. And it shows the RA needs based on several modeling approaches by E3, the Power Pool themselves, BPA's white book, et cetera. And those, the data in that, the material or the data they used in those plots is 3 to 4, sometimes 5 years old, and actually indicate at this point in time we should be short 2,000 megawatts of power, and we're not. At least far as I can tell, and I've, you know, confirmed this with other people, that those charts are really misleading to be using at this time because of the old data and the fact that they weren't correct. And about that, and WAPAD used these about a month or so ago, and I asked Ryan to, you know, hey, can't we get updated numbers from these people? You know, they ran these numbers, these RA numbers once before. Let's get an update on this stuff before we, you know, spend all this time and money in an RA program. That's all I had, Will.
Yeah. Jim, on that point, because I'm not 100% certain on that, but when you're planning, looking forward, and as much as your system is hydro and therefore variable, they typically use low water when they're projecting forward, assuming that maybe we'll have more water than that and then greater generation, but on a planning basis, they typically use critical water. And that's often why what they're forecasting is a lot less than what we end up with, because typically we'll get better than low water.
Yeah, noted. Thanks.
Okay, next item is staff reports, employee recognition. Nicole, are you on?
I'm on. Let me see. Sean, can I share my screen?
Yeah.
Okay. So just a little bit of light good news that I wanted to kind of call out some things that have just recently happened and let you guys know is the first is we have an employee photo calendar that we do every single year. And it's employees submit photos from around the state, scenic photos, and they get voted on. And we produce our next year's calendar based on that. And that was happening at and one of our linemen, Ivan Welch, had submitted a photo. And he ended up getting his voted to not only be in the calendar, but it had the most votes. And so he's going to be on the front cover. Well, meanwhile, I had asked him, I didn't want to influence our internal calendar voting, but I had asked him if I could submit that photo to the Northwest Public Power Association Communications Conference in their photography category. And while I was down there in October, I found out that he got second place in our utility size category. I just couldn't say anything to him or anybody until last week because, again, I didn't want to influence the voting for our calendar. So let me share my screen here. And go up here. Let's see.
Oh.
Get that up on the screen here. Can you see this photo?
Yeah.
Okay, that's the photo that he submitted. And the feedback from them, he actually achieved 49 out of 50 points possible. So it said pretty much if he had included the whole bumper on the truck, they would have had to flip a coin to decide between first and second place. So that was the photo that he had, that I had submitted on his behalf. And then last week I went over. Can you see him here?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's his certificate from the Northwest Public Power Association. I also gave him a gift card, and I'm going to get this out on, social media and our normal, probably in our next PUD hotline as well. He was very surprised. So the next bit of news was, especially since you commissioners do the drawing for this, is the Wapuna Scholarship ended up going to our employee Brent Maggard's daughter, Cheyenne.
Ah.
The really cool thing about this is, at least in the 13 years I've been here, I've never seen one of our employees' dependents be selected. And interestingly, up until I think last year maybe, it was always you would have the students' names submitted, and then it would just be a random drawing, as you know, and then that random drawing name would get sent to Wapuda, and then of all the 27 PUDs that submitted names, then they would have another random drawing. So it was just luck of the draw. But they last year started doing it where the applicants have to submit a complete packet that includes not only that they have to be eligible with a minimum GPA and they have to provide their transcript, they also have to provide a personal statement, a list of community and service projects, and then also an essay. So what we did was I didn't want to have, since we start the initial process with a random drawing by lot, I just let the applicants know that if your name gets selected, then you're going to have a week to turn in your essay. So be thinking about that topic. It has to be energy related. So Cheyenne has got an outstanding, not only her transcript, but her service She's in junior ROTC, involved in 4-H, involved in so many other volunteer projects. And I was just so happy. I let Brent know immediately when I got the email about it. And one of the things that Waputa wanted was a picture of the family in front of our logo and several other pictures that we have submitted so that they will be, she'll be recognized at the Waputa annual meeting, which this year is going to be virtual. So you'll be able to see the slideshow that they're putting together about her. But it's well-deserved, and I'm going to send out a news release this week about it. It's a $1,000 scholarship. So stop sharing. So that's what I had to report to you guys.
Thank you. T, do we have any action items captured?
Yes, Will, we have a couple action items here, actually more than a couple. The first one is a suggestion to have a customer service representative contact customers specifically in the Clallam Bay CQ area in order to obtain updates for their to their contact information, just to ensure that those customers receive any future PUD emergency robocall notifications. The second item that I noted was a request to continue to aggressively pursue more funding for Clallam Bay CQ water system restoration work, which our water and wastewater manager, Tom Martin, said that he is definitely planning to do. The third item is to develop a follow-up plan to revisit both midterm and long-term solutions to the water restoration issues in Clallam Bay CQ. And the last item was a suggestion to summarize BPA contract discussion points and opinions in the minutes. Now, I just want to remind the board that we do follow Robert's rules in the recording of minutes, and the purpose of the minutes is to create an official record of the board's actions, not to record discussions. So if the district wants to deviate from that in the future, that's a decision that I'm not authorized to make that decision. That's all I have.
Okay, thank you.
Well, Rick, Robert's rules are not mandates. They're just something that many people adopt. So I feel it's important for us to document I realize the recorder, but some sort of summary statement on the work we're trying to do on these 2028 contract process meetings.
Yeah, I wouldn't have a problem with a summary statement, but getting too specific with too much granularity would probably fill up a book.
Yes, it would.
Okay. Our second comments from the public. Sean, do we have any?
Nothing has come through the chat, but if anybody would like to make a comment, please give me your first name. Hearing none, Will.
Okay. There's a comment here. Donald Baker states there is a PUD well on the Clallam River that has been capped or capped, I don't know.
Capped. I forwarded that comment on to Tom.
Okay, good. All right. We do not have an executive session, so if there's no other business to come before the board, we will adjourn. Maybe I should make that a question. Is there any business to come before the board?
None for me.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Same to all of you. Don't overeat or try to travel. Okay. Thanks a lot, everyone.
Thank you.